Next up on This Week in Law, Mike Keyes and Margo Cruz join me. I'm Denise Howell. We're going to look at the Google Arts and Culture app and why it works in some states, but perhaps not in others. We'll look at a lot of big entertainment lawsuits. Is that Dragon Box better left alone because of its copyright infringing tendencies? We'll look at that. We'll talk about trademarking Comic-Con, Sabak, and Steve Jobs, and saving your immortal soul, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, Emery Roan, and Matt Curtis. Episode 411, recorded January 19th, 2018. Tesla's in space! This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Grammarly. Download Grammarly, the intelligent writing app, for free by visiting getgrammarly.com/twit. And by Grasshopper. Stay connected and run your business from your mobile phone with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, visit trygrasshopper.com/twit. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. You're joining us for episode 411 of This Week in Law. And guess what? We're going to have all the 411 for you on everything at the intersection of technology and law. Well, not everything, but what we have found particularly interesting over the break, the long holiday break that we have taken here at the end of 2017 and the beginning of 2018. So it's been really fun actually to put together this week's show because much has gone on while we've taken a bit of show hiatus here. So lots to catch up on. Great panel of folks to do that with today. My co-host Mike Keyes is here. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Denise. It's so great to be back.
Great to see you again. Happy 2018. Happy New Year.
Yeah, I know. We're almost halfway through the first month of the year. Hard to believe.
I know. It is hard to believe. But what's not hard to believe is some good news I read over the holiday break that not only is Mike, as longtime listeners of the show, know, a partner at Dorsey & Whitney in Seattle. You're now the office head up there. Congratulations.
I am. I've heard congratulations, condolences, and everything in between. So
yeah.
But it's gonna be a lot of fun. We've got a tremendous group here. So I'm excited to lead us into 2018 and beyond.
That's really, really exciting. Congratulations. I'm choosing to go the congratulatory route, although I'm sure condolences are probably in order. I'm just going to be optimistic about that. It's a lot of work.
It'll be a lot of work, but it's going to be a lot of fun too.
Yes. Good, good. Emery Roan, our other sometime co-host, would be here today, was scheduled to be here today. He's fine. His cat is not well, though. And goodness knows that when you have an emergency medical situation with a cat, all things internet grind to a halt. So it's only appropriate that we are wishing Emery all the best with his cat. And hope we'll see him soon on another episode in the very near future. In the meantime, though, we've got a great guest joining us this week. Margo Cruz is here with us. Hello, Margo.
Hi, how are you? It's so great to be on the show.
Very great to have you. Margo reached out to me because she's also doing a show that there was a wonderful, I don't know if I should call it a wonderful need. There was a definite need for Margo's show. She does a show called Tech Law Tracker, which tells you what's going on with technology law on the state level. Tell us a little bit more about your show, Marga.
Yeah, so I started this because I realized that it's just so difficult to keep on top of what's happening at the state level legislatures. And I wanted it to be easier for people to find out what's going on. And it's just so intimidating to read bills on your own. And I had a little bit of background in bill reading from an internship that I had. So I thought, why not start this? It's great preparation for law school. And I'll be starting law school in September. So that's the idea. I just read bills. They're usually really boring about whatever might be passing through a state legislature. Sometimes it's about, you know, a new cell phone law. Sometimes it's a huge omnibus bill about telecoms regulations in that state. Like, you know, where are you going to put the new Fios lines or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a lot of fun. I started it in November, and yeah, I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, it's an important thing to pay attention to. So we're glad that you're doing that. And we have various and sundry examples of how it's important in our lineup for today. So we'll point that out as they pop up. Where are you going to be going to law school, Margo?
So I actually don't know yet. I'm currently debating between a few schools. I may stay here in New York, or there's a small chance that I will go to North Carolina. So I'll see. I'm actually still waiting to hear back from a few, so I don't want to count my chickens before they hatch.
Sure. Well, wonderful. Good luck.
Thank you.
Know that's a difficult process when you're waiting. So yeah. I guess condolences are in order for you too.
Thank
but I'll
you.
choose to be optimistic about it and offer congratulations.
I'm feeling good so far.
Good. Yeah. All right. Well, speaking of the 411, let's start out with a copyright story. I find this super interesting. One of the reasons we started doing this show back in 2006 had to do with the fact that copyright law had been extended so, the term of copyright had been extended so far and on two different instances by lawmakers in the United States that very few things were falling into the public domain. And so fair use was becoming much more prevalent, necessary, as the internet was evolving and people were forging ahead with creating things that hadn't fallen out of copyright yet. Well, fast forward now to January of 2018 and specifically to January 1st of 2019, next year. That is the date when every book, film, song, and other copyrighted creative work in the United States will fall out of copyright protection under existing law, even with the two copyright term extensions that we've seen from Congress in recent years. And so there's an interesting piece over at Ars Technica by Timothy Lee pointing this out and sort of pondering, well, are we going to see lawmakers race in to keep Steamboat Willie under copyright again, the way that they've done in times past when this was going to happen? And it seems like we may not. Timothy reached out to people at the RIAA and the MPAA, and nobody there sounds terribly interested in lobbying Congress, urging them to extend our copyright term yet again. Timothy's speculation on that is that it's just become kind of a politically unpopular position to take. Copyright terms are already extraordinarily long. And if we were to undergo another extension, if that were to get debated in Washington by lawmakers, it probably wouldn't be a very popular position to espouse to extend that term longer. So there would be a very low likelihood of them just sort of slipping a copyright term extension by in this age of the internet and in the wake of SOPA and PIPA and the outrage that we saw and the mobilization that we saw over that. So it may be that on January 1st, 2019, works from 1923 will go into the public domain, and works from each successive year, 24, the following year, et cetera, will start to have a more robust public domain. What do you think about all this, Mike?
I think Timothy's article is fascinating, and I totally agree with him. I mean, wow, what a huge cultural shift we've seen here over the last 20 years. You know, as you mentioned, back in 1998, Congress enacted the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act. It acted to extend a whole bunch of works that were poised to fall into the public domain. You mentioned Steamboat Willie. That was certainly one of the original Disney creations. There were other works by George and Ira Gershwin. You know, the Gershwin estate was a big proponent of the Sonny Bono Act, and so were a lot of other content creators. So it's so interesting to think about the dynamic and how that has shifted, you know, with some of the big technology companies that are, you know, pushing for more limitations on copyrights. Google, for example, I think is a great example. It's interesting to see how this has really shifted in a major way. So I think it's probably accurate to state that we're unlikely to see more extensions happen. And I mean, ultimately, you know, it's the extensions that happen, you know, life of the author plus 75 years, that's a long, long time. And so I think we've reached kind of the apex of copyright protection in terms of how long it is. So
Timothy Lee actually reached out to the Authors Guild for feedback on his piece or input into his piece. And the Authors Guild came back to him and said, hey, we'd actually like to see it rolled back. We'd like to see Life Plus 50 because our members need to have a robust public domain to create their works as well. So I think it's really fascinating and an interesting sign of the times. What do you think, Margo?
I have to agree. I mean, it seems silly to have it even be so long after life, 75 years. I guess the whole point of copyright law is to create a good incentive to write and, you know, create new works. But if the author himself or herself isn't even seeing those returns, then I don't really see the point as a non-legal opinion. It seems like it makes sense to maybe roll it back because unless I don't know of like a seriously good reason to keep it going longer than 75 years. Interesting stuff.
Start to have more access to works created in, well, not that we're in the 20th century anymore, but we shortly, not too long ago, were. So
Margo, you bring up a really good point about the underlying incentives with respect to our copyright laws. Of course, the Copyright Act, you know, the basis for it is in the Constitution itself, which provides that you know, Congress can pass legislation that protects works for limited times. And so, you know, it is supposed to be of limited duration, and the whole purpose and rationale behind copyright is to make sure that authors and creators are properly incentivized. And are we getting to the point, if it went beyond 75 years, that, you know, the incentive piece is pretty much out of the equation? I mean, no one's creating works knowing, oh, I'm going to create this work because it's going to last for 75 years. I mean, it's just kind of beyond everybody's purview. And that was one of the original challenges to the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act initially was, you know, you've kind of removed this whole incentive. You've basically made it irrelevant by extending the term so long. So I think this is a welcome development, and it's going to be interesting and fun to see the works as they lapse, fall into the public domain, and what creative people are going to be doing with those works once they're free and open to the public.
Yeah, that makes so much sense actually, and I think that you know, what benefit does, say, so and so created Mickey Mouse? I mean, Walt Disney created Mickey Mouse, but he wasn't thinking about, oh wow, my grandchildren, my great grandchildren will have, you know, the proceeds of this work. And also, it would be so nice if we could just have more public domain works. After a certain point, you should be able to buy that book or poem for like $3. I mean, if the author themselves is not gaining a benefit, seems like it would be good if it was accessible to everyone.
All right. Well, we're already sort of talking about issues relating to the entertainment realm. The rest of this next batch of stories are squarely there. So let's play the bumper. That bumper works well during award season, I think. So this, too, is just really, really fascinating. Lots to unpack here. Spotify has been sued now by a company called Wixen Music Publishing. They are seeking a whopping amount of damages, $1.6 billion over licensing issues, obviously, related to songs by Tom Petty and Donald Fagen, Neil Young, many, many others. This entity, Wixen Music Publishing, is in charge of song compositions by those artists. And it has actually gotten involved in other lawsuits against Spotify. You may recall that Spotify had to settle a class action by songwriters. That still has not been finalized by the court, but there is a proposed $43 million settlement in that case that Wixen got involved in, didn't want that settlement to happen, wanted to get its clients out of the class there, didn't think that it was enough. Obviously, $43 million is a lot less than $1.6 billion. So Wixen backed up their arguments in the former case by deciding to sue independently on behalf of their own clients. And there's a lot of interesting moving parts. Obviously, there's a lot of the very confusing labyrinth of music licensing that is involved in that case. We have some indication from Spotify how it's going to combat this based on what it did when Wixen got involved in the case that they're trying to settle. One of the arguments that Spotify has advanced is that Wixen's not actually authorized by the musicians that it represents per the terms of its agreements with those musicians to engage in litigation. So that might be something that we see there. They're authorized to administer the licenses, but there's nothing specifically that says that they're allowed to sue about it. So that may be something that we see. Another interesting twist could be that, and this would be a big deal if Spotify were able to get this to fly, that streaming technologies actually don't impact the rights that are at stake in this case, reproduction or distribution rights under copyright law. So we've got those interesting moving parts there. It also was filed on New Year's Eve. And you might wonder, well, why are they racing to get that case filed before January 1st, 2018? That's because there is proposed legislation right now in Congress called the Music Modernization Act, which would try and simplify some of the labyrinth of music licensing and would try to make it easier if you are a streaming service to carry out your business, and by the same token, would increase the amount of money going to artists by those services. So there are a lot of moving parts going on with this case. It has just been filed, so we will have to stay tuned and see how Spotify responds and what becomes of it. But we wanted to let you know that it and this Music Modernization Act are both on the table right now. Mike, what do you make of all this?
Yeah, this is a really interesting case. The complaint paints, to my estimation, a pretty compelling case of what happened here. You know, as you mentioned, Denise, music copyright, it's complex for sure. I mean, there are multiple copyrights at play in any musical work. You've got the sound recording, take a just take a typical song that's recorded by a music label, you've got the sound recording copyright, which is the music notes that are fixed in the sound recording along with any lyrics. And that's a separate copyright. But then accompanying that is the composition right, the actual written music itself on the page. And in order to stream a piece of music or publicly perform it, you really need both rights. We'd need to get permission from the copyright owner in the sound recording, and you'd need to get permission from the underlying copyright holder of the composition. So you really got two levels of clearance that you'd have to go through, and it can be a rather complex labyrinth to work through. And what the complaint is saying is, look, they may have cleared the sound recording rights and may have negotiated with the labels themselves, but that's only part of the equation. You still need to get what's called a mechanical license, which is the license that you would get from the composers. So, you know, that's interesting. You know, there's lots of questions of fact as to what happened there. And so that's a big interesting wrinkle in the piece. And then you brought up all the other issues too. There's a lot to this case. And of course, the amount of damages that they're claiming are staggering, $1.6 billion. So lots at stake here in this one.
The plaintiffs here contend that as much as 21% of the music on Spotify is not properly licensed, which is obviously a huge chunk of the catalog. And it underscores your point, Mike, how complicated these laws are. If anybody's legal team is incentivized to get this right, it is Spotify and Apple Music and the rest of the streaming services. And the fact that they're vulnerable to this kind of claim is really telling. Margo, where were you reading bills when you were reading bills before deciding to go to law school?
Oh, funny story. So I had an internship at MALDEF. It's a public interest law firm, and I was in the education policy area. I was their education policy intern because I was not a law student like the rest of the interns. I was a poli-sci student. And so I ended up being like the right hand of the legislative staff attorney, and she was incredible. And for her, I ended up doing a lot of her legislative stuff. I read bills for her, and I like summarized some bills, and we would put out press releases about different bills that she thought were particularly important. So that's how I got familiar with the whole bill process and the state right. legislation. And it was just fascinating to me. Like, that's actually what convinced me to go to law school. Because before I was really interested in public policy and education policy and stuff like that and international law. And just seeing the effect that a state level law has on day-to-day life was incredible to me.
So they were state bills you were reading, not things in D.C.?
Yeah, state bills. That was actually in Texas. They have a... they have a division in Texas and a division in D.C., MALDEF.
Yeah.
And I randomly got sent to Texas. It was super interesting. I had never been there before. I'm a lifelong New Yorker, born and raised. So, different, but not super different at the end of the day. And also at the end of the day, all the state legislative websites are very similar.
Yeah.
So that just taught me how to even go through that process and learn what a bill is all about and track it and see what sort of actions have happened on the bill. And I learned through that the vast majority of bills that get proposed never make it into any sort of committee, or maybe they get assigned to a committee, but not, they go no further than that.
Right. And that's something a lot of people may not realize that is true, not just at the state level, but also in D.C., and it's a point that Eric Gardner raises when he wrote up this Wixon Music case against Spotify, is that even if this Music Modernization Act makes sense and is vital and necessary to solve the problem that is leading to these lawsuits and is confusing even the likes of Spotify's lawyers, that what may well happen with this is there's so much else that our lawmakers in Washington have to concern themselves with right now that this may just never even make it to or out of committee and become a law, which is sad to think about, but true. Mike, do you agree with Eric that even though this is a piece of legislation whose time has come, that Congress may have their eyes on other prizes at the moment?
Yeah, that may very well be right.
Yeah.
There's so many different moving parts here and so many different stakeholders, and Congress has got all sorts of other stuff going on. It's kind of hard to predict with any sort of clarity or certainty here.
Well, we can only hope they get their stuff together and start turning to making laws that the country needs and not just on the big political issues. This is obviously something that's important to a lot of people. So hopefully they can get around to considering it. Let's see. What else do we have in our entertainment realm here? Oh, this is fascinating. Speaking of, it's a good segue to the next story after this too. Listener Gary Pelton, thank you everybody who continued to send us stuff that we should pay attention to while we were off on break. Gary Pelton was one such person, and he pointed me toward a tweet of someone named Sebastian Tomczak, if I'm saying his name correctly, who created a 10-hour white noise video. Purely just listening to static white noise, and people like to listen to this stuff. It's relaxing. It's it helps you focus. It might help you go to sleep. So he put out a 10-hour white noise video, and it's telling that he had already received, and who knows, may now have received more DMCA takedown notices specified to certain specific portions of the white noise video. So sad sort of reflection on the fact that Content ID over at YouTube is still a work in progress, and it's flagging things like white noise as infringing various right holders' copyrights. So Sebastian Tomczak, good luck with your DMCA takedown notices. Hopefully he has some assistance in being able to combat them, because it seems like this would be a good instance to challenge the DMCA takedown notices he's been receiving. Surprising, Mike, or no?
I was surprised. I mean, you hear stories about this all the time, but I was surprised given white noise. I'm not sure what the copyrightable content is associated with that. Right. White noise itself has a very functional purpose. I used it multiple times over the years with our three kids, getting them to sleep. Mm-hmm. It's funny. It's interesting. I'd love to know the story behind how this ultimately happened, but obviously the algorithm does need some work, as you pointed out.
Yeah, he posted this to Twitter, and you can see that thread and all of the stories and everything else we're discussing today. If you head over to tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw, we're on episode 411 here today. And that link and all the rest of our links we've referred to today will be there for you to peruse at your leisure. Someone on that thread said, hey, well, your white noise basically incorporates everything on YouTube, so it was bound to get caught on something there. Any thoughts, Margo?
That just – Content ID is so interesting to me because I learned about it by – just looking for a song on YouTube. You know, you're searching for so-and-so song, but it just sounds a little off. And you would click around and just find a better version. But I started realizing that there were so many songs that they just sounded slightly offbeat or like slightly sped up. And I asked my boyfriend about it, and he like loves to research all this stuff. And he goes, yeah, that's like the Content ID system. I started looking into it. I guess apparently it just tags stuff that might not actually be copyrighted. Anyway,
Yes, sometimes it does.
Yeah. So very fascinating how all that works. I don't even know, you know, how this specific things happen, like a sleeping baby, soothing baby sleep. Who knows? But yeah. I wish I had more to say.
It's okay.
Interesting stuff.
It's worth noting, but not too much to go into detail there with Sebastian's dilemma. It is interesting though that content ID systems on sites like YouTube and Facebook not only have to try and accurately identify something that might be subject to infringement that's under that is under copyright and that a rights holder might object to, they also have to identify things that are under copyright but that the right holder has approved, because both YouTube and now Facebook have deals with major record labels. Just this week, Facebook and Universal Music Group announced a global agreement that now allows Facebook users to upload videos featuring music from Universal's library across their network, as well as on Instagram and Oculus. So the algorithm is constantly having to be tuned. Oh, well, these songs are okay. These songs are not. We just did a deal. So I'm not surprised that it doesn't always work perfectly. This is a big push by Facebook, clearly, to compete with the YouTube universe. And allow people, you know, Facebook for a while now has been trying to encourage users to upload original videos. Oftentimes music is involved in that. So this will help smooth things over for some of those users and make Facebook more competitive on that front. They have agreements with both Universal Music Group now and Sony Music Entertainment. So just wanted to point that out for you folks. Another really fascinating issue here involves Disney and Redbox. Redbox is that great big thing that you see at the grocery store or down at Walmart or what have you, where you can rent DVDs, much like you used to do at Blockbuster. You can put in your card and take home a DVD and then bring it back to Redbox and return it after you've watched it. Redbox, though, you know, wants to acknowledge the fact that maybe not everybody wants to watch a DVD these days. Maybe people are more interested in consuming their digital entertainment in a more digitally native fashion or in a fashion that is facilitated by streaming, I guess would be the more accurate way to put that. So what Redbox decided to do, and which Disney was not happy about at all, and I'm sure Disney's not the only company it did this to, but Disney has decided to sue. Redbox was disassembling a combo DVD pack for various Disney titles. The combo pack included a Blu-ray disc, a DVD, and a code. The code could be redeemed through various digital outlets. So how Disney intended this to work is they would sell their combo packs directly to you, me, and everyone else, not to Redbox. They did not contemplate a middleman in this process making money on this process. But Disney wanted end consumers to be able to have that streaming option if they had the proper code. They did not want Redbox to be able to do that and involve themselves in that process. So Disney is suing and assumes that Redbox is violating their terms of service. Disney is already trying to head off Redbox's for sale doctrine argument. That would give anyone who purchased a copy of a copyrighted work the right to sell, use, dispose of that particular copy, notwithstanding the interests of the copyright holder. Disney is saying, no, the code doesn't fall under that. The code is not the work. The work is what we're giving you access to with the code. and that is still copyrighted, and Redbox is not authorized to distribute the codes. I think it'll be really interesting to see if this question comes up in the litigation, and that is whether Disney and other studios have left Redbox or should be required to leave Redbox any feasible legal avenue of offering its customers a digital download that doesn't involve negotiating a license for that download or streaming component with the studios. So is there a way that Redbox can offer a streaming or download component that doesn't subject them to an infringement claim and that doesn't require them to negotiate a license? I think their hands are kind of tied. What do you think, Mike?
You think Redbox's hands are tied?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, you know, this was kind of a creative thing that they tried here. I don't think it'll work. What do you think?
I think you're probably right. I mean, we're a bit on the bleeding edge here. Mm-hmm. You know, and Redbox, I think, is trying to come up with some creative arguments. But at the end of the day, I think that's probably right, that this is probably not authorized under the Copyright Act. I think the fair use, or excuse me, the first sale doctrine, that strikes me as Disney's got the better argument here. But you know, this is, we're kind of in uncharted territory a bit with the unique situation here in terms of the business model and the code, and you know, is the code subject to this claim of first sale or not? So to me, it seems as though the better argument is with the studios.
Yeah. I think I'm with you on that. Margo, I know you haven't gone to law school yet, but have you ever, you know, you're a younger person. I can tell this about you. Have you even ever encountered a Redbox or a DVD?
I actually have. I'm not that young. the funny thing was that I had Netflix pretty early because my mom, not being very technologically savvy, but she did catch on to Netflix. I had Netflix probably within its first couple of years. And then I went to Jersey to visit my friend, and she was like, oh, let's get a Redbox. And so I was very confused by this whole concept, but learned what a Redbox is. Because in the city, in New York, I just never saw a Redbox before. It was all Netflix. but that being said, I'm on this streaming thing. I have a bit of a question, because you specified that with music streaming, you need the approval for it's like as if it's a live performance rather than reproduction and selling. And I might have this wrong, so let me know if I am wrong. Where you need double permission for the actual composition and for the music performance part. And then I'm curious if with streaming of movies, it's a similar deal, or if there's something else or some triple permission you need, because there's also a visual element. That's a general question. I don't know.
Yeah, that's actually a really good question, Margo. I think what you're saying is, in a similar vein to how music copyright works, are there kind of separate copyrights associated with the reproduction or performance of an audiovisual work, such as a movie? Would you need to get permission, say, to the underlying screenplay itself, the stuff that's written on the paper, if you will? Is that essentially your question?
Yeah, basically.
I don't think it operates in the same way. I believe the law is, when it comes to an audiovisual work, such as a movie, publication of the movie itself, once that is published, that also constitutes a publication of the underlying screenplay. So I don't think you have the same bifurcated rights that you do with respect to a music composition. But it's a really good question.
Yeah, it is a good question. It's a good reason to think about why we treat music and film so differently in that regard.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating because actually before you said that, I didn't know that a stream is considered a live performance because I would just assume it's like a reproduction and selling. But that does make sense on a certain level. But I guess with a lot of newer laws, it's just you have to make this attempt to like apply an older law to that situation, to the new situation created by the technology. Yeah, that was just really fascinating to me. I didn't know that.
All right. Also, another really interesting lawsuit filed recently. How would you like to be facing a lawsuit filed by the likes of, all together lined up against you, Netflix, Amazon, Columbia Pictures, Disney, Paramount Pictures, 20th Century Fox, Universal, and Warner Brothers? That's just a lot.
Yeah.
And it's pending in the Central District of California, which, newsflash, is LA. So definitely courts familiar with and used to handling litigation brought by those entities or by a good chunk of those entities. The lucky defendant here is something called Dragonbox, which has a lawyer named Eric Syverson, who is very bullish on his client's position. Dragonbox, as near as I can tell, the author at Ars Technica, which was John Brodkin, who wrote this up, tried to get some details from Eric Syverson, the lawyer, about exactly what it is his client's box is doing. And Eric dodged that question and said, oh, well, I just got involved in the case and I'm still trying to figure out all the technology. So even their lawyers not quite sure what this box is doing. But I think what the box is doing is just providing, it's a computer. And it's providing a database of links to what it knows are places where you can get free digital content online, entertainment content that you would not be prohibited from accessing in one way or another. So I imagine that means that there's a bunch of stuff that you could just stream from your computer in a perfectly legal way. And I imagine that it also means, and this is why the lawsuit has been filed by all of these various entities, that it means that it's pointing you towards places on the internet where things are available to stream that aren't authorized to be there. And that if the various entities lined up against Dragon were able to go after each and every one of the moles that needed to be whacked that were putting unauthorized material out there, they would do so. But instead I'm sure they're trying to do that as well, but they're also going after Dragon, which seems to be washing its hands of any response to you service which state Dragon does not host, provide, archive, store, or distribute media of any kind and acts merely as an indexed or directory of media posted by other enthusiasts on the internet, which is completely outside of our control. This did not go well for Napster. I do not see it going well for Dragon. What do you think, Mike?
I totally agree. I mean, this is Grokster 2.0.
Yeah.
Recall that Grokster went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court found that Grokster could be held liable for contributory copyright infringement, essentially secondary liability. But Grokster, it seems to me, made very – or Dragonbox folks are making, I think, a very similar argument to what Grokster made at the Supreme Court, which is, hey, look, we're not – you know, people are using our service to share Shakespeare and all sorts of works that are in the public domain. And the Supreme Court rejected that argument, saying, look, your business model is based on people exchanging and swapping and trading creating copyrighted works. And when you facilitate that and you have reason to know that your users are doing that, then you can potentially be liable under our Copyright Act. It seems to me this is virtually indistinguishable from that rationale. You get on Dragonbox website, when I was on there earlier, it looked like they were touting the fact that you can get all sorts of free movies, even movies that are still in the theaters, and you don't have to pay that $70 cable bill anymore. It's like,
oh dear,
that's under Grokster, I think they might be dead in the water.
Yeah,
could you think of a stronger team of plaintiffs that you're facing than all the ones that are lined up against you? I think it's time to reconsider.
What I do think is really interesting about this is I think there would be a market for a box that worked like a computer but was much more convenient than simply hooking up a computer to your TV and provided you with legally authorized stuff. It would be a far more limited universe of things that you could access. But I bet there's a market for people who don't want to pay for cable or satellite and do want to enjoy the fact that there's a lot available on the internet, but just make it more convenient and more sort of TV friendly. And if that's what a Dragonbox was, I would say more power to them. And I hope they're able to fight this and that Eric Syverson is justified in his confidence in his client's case. But based on what you're seeing on their website, Mike, I don't think that's what's going on here. Margo, any thoughts?
Yeah, this is interesting, especially when compared to the Napster thing. In the big scheme picture, I think that, even though Napster lost, the music industry as a whole changed so much since the age of CDs. And it's just interesting to me because the music industry turned into, instead of artists making their money from the sales of the records, they make all their money off of touring now. And so many artists that I love just release music for free and you can listen anywhere you'd like. But the concert tickets are a lot more expensive, but it's like, that's the trade-off. But I think it's interesting to see like industries that have had a stronghold on a certain vein of money making. Maybe they don't have to shift it, but that vein is being challenged. And so in the music industry, at the end of the day, the artists are still, they still have an incentive to produce great music because they still have a way to make money. And I wonder if that will ever shift in movies. Maybe it won't, but I'm personally a cord cutter, they say. I don't do cable or anything like that most of my friends are like this. Yeah. We just watch Netflix and stuff. And, there's plenty of content out there on YouTube. I recently started watching a YouTube Red series that was fun and seemed like a lot like, a sitcom I might watch on TV when I was a kid. So it's all really interesting to see the industry shifting itself. And I wonder if that sort of shift is going to continue. That sums up my thoughts.
Yeah. I this is all reminding me that does anybody remember Google TV? There was a Google box that was like an Apple TV.
Right.
That was trying to do this the legal way, and it was getting blocked because content producers didn't want people to be able to access their material that way. And that was real. That to me is a real legal problem. That something that just makes it convenient to do what a browser can already do shouldn't be blocked. Now, obviously, that doesn't seem to be what we're talking about with Dragonbox here. But I think that this is a stay tuned moment. That as there are more and more cord cutters like Margo out there who don't just want to be sitting in front of their computer necessarily or their tablet or their phone or whatever, but actually want that lay back on the couch and watch TV experience, that we've got a technology gap there that there is a legal way to fill, I would think. but no one has gone that route yet. All right. Let's take a break for a moment and thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is Grammarly. Grammarly's AI-powered products help people communicate more effectively. Please, 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 if you're a parent, pay attention to what I'm about to say to you right now about Grammarly. I don't know about the other parents out there, but I am enlisted all the time to help proofread, grammar check my children's work. And I'm happy to do it. But at some point, you have to make them independent enough to be responsible for that kind of thing themselves. And at some point, they go off to college and need to be responsible for that kind of thing themselves. And definitely having something vet your writing before you release it to the world is a great idea. And Grammarly, I think, is a wonderful, wonderful tool that might even be able to do a better job than I do as far as proofreading and suggesting corrections. What you do is you copy and paste any English text into Grammarly's online text editor, or you install Grammarly's free browser extension for Chrome, Safari, and Firefox. And then it looks at your work and it corrects hundreds of grammar, punctuation, and spelling mistakes while also catching contextual errors, improving your vocabulary, and suggesting style improvements. Grammarly scans your text for common and complex grammatical mistakes, subject-verb agreement, modifier placement, comma splice, weak adjectives, missing articles. Grammarly's powerful algorithms are developed by the world's leading linguists and language lovers. Improve your skills with Grammarly's detailed explanations for all your mistakes and weekly progress reports. So it actually will help you become a better writer. So not only if you're a parent, if you're someone who writes a lot for a living, like, say, a lawyer, obviously, if you have colleagues in your law firm, hopefully many of you are reading one another's work and performing this function. But certainly with the linguists and language experts at Grammarly, makes sense to get them involved in the process as well. You will write confidently and mistake-free, whether you're just drafting an email, a social media post, or a brief or a paper. All of the things that where your writing matters, it makes sense to check out Grammarly's tools. Their tips. They have Facebook and Twitter accounts where you're going to find grammar tips and discussions. And the Grammarly blog as well offers daily tips and insights on how to improve your day-to-day writing to achieve personal and professional goals. Get started and join more than 10 million happy Grammarly Chrome users today. Download Grammarly now for free at getgrammarly.com/twit. That's getgrammarly.com/twit. Thank you so much, Grammarly, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, let's move on to a privacy story. This is not only a privacy story, but a state law story where it's various states have different laws than other states. We talk a lot about this on the show about how California has some very stringent privacy laws that other states sort of find themselves or businesses find themselves complying with California privacy laws in order to be able to operate there. And that means their practices have to meet standards that maybe they wouldn't have to meet in other states. This particular story involves the states of Illinois and Texas, where you were reading bills, Margo.
Yes.
If you've been under a rock for the last week, perhaps you have missed Google's Arts and Culture app. If you haven't been under a rock, then you have seen countless instances of Google's Arts and Culture app, not just exposing us all to more art and culture in our lives, but specifically matching up various individuals' faces with various works of art throughout history. People seem completely enthralled with this, fascinated by it, love seeing if Google's able to match them up with something flattering or not, something that seems to be a close match or not. There have been some very, very funny pairings and some very spot on ones made by the app. And it's very funny. There's a Wall Street Journal piece that we've linked to in the discussion points where, and I'm sure this is not the only person who had this response to the app. I downloaded it. And of course, one of the first things you want to do is find out, how do I take this selfie and match myself up with artworks? And you have to kind of dig around in the app for that. And there's a person, a 26-year-old that was interviewed for the WSJ piece named Megan Vo, who said, it's a great app with a lot of resources, but I just wanted to take a selfie. She was sort of discouraged that when she first launched it, that wasn't the very first thing that she saw. But clearly, many, many people are sticking with the interface, finding out where they can take a selfie and match themselves up with various artworks. Well, users in Illinois and Texas found that they might not be able to do that. And the reason there is that those states have various state laws that deal with biometrics and facial recognition. And it's kind of making everyone on the legal side scratch their head, because the app actually seems to be doing what it needs to do. In those states, you're not supposed to take biometric data from people without getting their consent. The app gets your consent before it will allow you to take that selfie and match yourself up. So people are a little perplexed why Google saw fit to block access or make access difficult for users in Illinois and Texas. Various users are using a VPN so that they can get around those blocks. But we're not quite sure why Google opted to go that route. Anyway, it is getting sued about facial recognition in Google Photos in goodness which state, one of the two, I think Illinois. So had to bring this up because it's so topical and it involves state law. Margo, are you surprised to see that there's some variation state by state in what you can do with people's biometric data?
Absolutely not surprised. It's interesting. It's really fun to see, you know, what states do, what some states have a congressperson who's really strong on one issue, and you know, some states just have different overall opinions. This was really fascinating, just because the whole, I guess I, from my understanding of it, the whole idea of consent, but then, you know, it's buried somewhere in a long legal document. And I've heard you guys talk about this on the show before. You know, when you're signing, yes, I agree to the terms and conditions for a 1,000-page, okay, maybe like 50-page long document. What does that mean to the average person? Not even the average person, to anyone. I'm assuming that's kind of the issue here. Right. For those specific states, because they were a little over, the person said, Alvador Bedoya said, like, maybe this was being overly cautious to block it in these states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes. I'm a bit perplexed why certainly Apple is selling the iPhone 10 in those states, and yeah. It's doing some heavy duty biometric facial mapping. What do you think,
Absolutely.
Mike? I love this app. It is so fun. I actually was playing around with it, and I'm pleased to report that I was matched up with a painting of John Philip Sousa.
That's great.
Which is really funny. Once that happened, I sent it to my kids, because every 4th of July, I play kind of all day long John Philip Sousa marches. And so I was quite pleased to hear that I was matched up with a painting of him.
And not to mention that you enjoy expounding in verse that sounds a lot like Dr. Sousa.
Oh, yeah. Yes, indeed.
Yes. That's great.
Yeah, it's a great app. I hope our listeners will download and play with it. And it's very educational too. It's got a bunch of other great functionalities on it.
Yes, it's really cool. I think it's a great way for Google or, you know, anybody who does something like this to take the cultural heritage of the world and make it accessible to people who, you know, might not be wandering into the National Gallery today, but they still have some exposure to the works that are there, and those works have some currency to their life. And how do you make it more current than to show someone who they look like, or who an app thinks they look like? So it's definitely entertaining and worthwhile, I would say.
The lookalikes are uncanny sometimes. When you see, I saw plenty of memes on the subject. I haven't done it myself yet.
Is anybody here concerned on the privacy front? Google says we will only use your image that you send us to match you with art, and we won't use it for any other purpose whatsoever. It does give that assurance. Does anybody feel like this is just not a good idea, Mike?
Oh, yes, I guess part of me feels like there could be problems with it, but I was so I was so curious about it once I read the stories and saw things on it, I just couldn't resist.
That's how they get you, Mike. That's how they get you.
I'm a sucker. What can I say? I'm a total sucker.
That's right.
Yeah, I would say I'm probably the same amount concerned that I would be for any of the other facial recognition technologies. It's not like, I mean, you sign an agreement that says, yeah, sure, we won't do anything about with this. And, you know, I hope that's the way it is. But also, it's such a fun app. So there's like this whole concept of like privacy, like consent to give away privacy, that seems like it's being twisted a little bit when some people say that these things are an example of people being willing to share private details about themselves. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about this one article I read, actually from somebody at Stanford Law, where they did this study where they said, well, we want to see how averse people are to sharing privacy, to sharing private details about themselves or about their friends. And, you know, how willing they are to do that in exchange for something. And the thing was, we'll give you a coupon for a free slice of pizza if you write down 3 friends' email addresses and share them with us. And that was somehow a measure of privacy, or a measure of giving away privacy in exchange for something. And I thought that was interesting. It's like, yeah, so I'll put my face up on the selfie, and now you can match it up to a photograph. In exchange for, now I get to see who I look like in an older painting. And it's fascinating stuff, but does that count as consenting to give away your likeness or something? I don't know. That would be weird.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point you raise. And I do think that studies like that are fascinating and worthwhile to see, you know, what people will trade for what. But I hope that they take into account the fact that you can just put Hermione at Hogwarts.com and, you know, submit something like that. People hopefully are savvy enough to know that they wouldn't actually have to put down a real email address, and can still avail themselves of the wonderful pizza benefit or whatever they're being offered. Do we have anything else on this? I don't know. Mike, any last thoughts?
Nothing further on this end.
All right, good. Then let us cobble together some sort of MCLE passphrase from this discussion. How about Mike is Sousa as our first MCLE passphrase for this week in law? We put these phrases in case you are a lawyer or a professional in a different field where we're putting stuff out into the universe that you could possibly use as professional credit in your field. We do discuss cutting edge legal issues at the intersection of technology and law here at This Week in Law, week in and week out. And we know that some of you like to submit to your local CLE, continuing legal education oversight boards, to help fill your education requirements. So we try and make that easier for you by putting a couple of passphrases in case you need to demonstrate that you actually watched or listened to the show. Our first one for this show is Mike is Souza. We will put another one in before we conclude today's episode. And if you'd like some more information and are a lawyer in the United States, head on over to wiki.twit.tv, find our This Week in Law page there, and we've got a chart there for you that will help you understand who your oversight board might be and what you might need to do to start that process rolling. So with that, we will move on to our next topic, which is trademark. Good trademark stuff this week, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Should we start with Comic-Con?
Yes.
Yes. So something happened in December while we were on hiatus. Can you explain to us what that was?
Sure. So I was surprised about this case. I mean, I had heard about it. I had always assumed for all these years that Comic-Con was just a generic term that's used for comic conventions. But unbeknownst to me, and I think a lot of other folks, it's actually a registered trademark owned by, I think it's the San Diego Comic-Con Convention. Some entity in San Diego owns this trademark. It's a registered trademark. And they brought a suit for infringement against a group in, I believe, based in Utah or Salt Lake City somewhere, over its use of the trademark Comic-Con. And there was actually a trial, and the San Diego folks were asking for, I want to say, $2 million in damages, asking for an injunction. And ultimately, the jury verdict came down and found, I believe, that that the defendants were liable for infringement, but only awarded about $20,000 in damages. So both sides were kind of displeased with what happened. Of course, the plaintiff wanted more damages, thought it was entitled to much more than $20,000, and the defendant or defendants rather were upset because they believed that a bunch of evidence was excluded that shouldn't have been, that would have shown that this particular trademark was generic. So after the jury verdict came out, the defendants did file a motion for a new trial asking for the verdict to be set aside and essentially taking aim at some of the court's pretrial rulings that excluded a bunch of evidence that the defendants say the jury should have been allowed to hear regarding the generic nature of this trademark. So we'll see what happens. I don't think that there's been a ruling on the post-trial motions yet, but you know, I think the defendants have said that they're going to appeal unless they get a new trial. So this is, you know, this issue comes up a lot in trademark disputes, that a particular mark is generic, that it's used so broadly and so widely by many people in a particular industry that it's become generic. And there's a whole host of trademarks over the years that have been subject to a generic argument and where defendants have won. Lots of trademarks used to be protectable. You know, cellophane is a good example. Escalator, aspirin, you know, all of those at one point were protectable trademarks, but now they've all become generic.
And but so not this, Velcro.
Not Velcro. That's right. That's right. They are adamant about they still have a protectable trademark, and of course they've gone to very creative lengths to protect that Velcro mark. So. But this is an interesting case. It seems to me, I mean, not knowing the evidence, but just kind of generally being familiar with the trademark, it seems to me that defendants have a pretty decent argument here, that people don't associate Comic-Con with a particular source. They associate it with the idea of a comic convention, no matter where it's held. Now that's kind of my outsider's view of the situation, but this is going to be an interesting one to keep tabs on and see what happens.
Yeah, and it seems pretty rancorous too at this point. The plaintiffs here who won, they didn't win as much money as they wanted, but they did win. So they're kind of cranky about their win at this point as well. They also are cranky about the fact that various strategies that were undertaken before and during the litigation by the other side, and they're seeking $4.5 million in attorney's fees, which seems kind of high, but I'm sure they'll be able to put out the statements and show exactly how they were made to do all this work, et cetera. So they're not pleased, and they're hoping to get their attorney's fees because they did not get as much in damages as they were asking for. Not just because I'm sure that they probably would be pursuing the attorney's fees even if they had gotten as much in damages as they asked for, but they're kind of cranky about how things went here as well. So it'll be interesting to see. And I feel like the chapter on this is by no means, well, the chapter might be closed, but the book is not, and that we might see cross appeals from the parties about the various ways in which they're dissatisfied with what happened at trial. Another case that is just starting out its life as a lawsuit is one that I find hilarious. I would say you wouldn't want to be Wren Ventures in this case. Wren Ventures decided to think about that name. Decided to launch a mobile game of Sabacc, which is the card game in which the Millennium Falcon changed hands and became the property of Han Solo from Lando Calrissian in Star Wars. So Lucasfilm is not real pleased over this. Is suing about the trademark in the game and the name Sabacc, and Lucasfilm is adamant that the defendants claim they first used this mark in 2015, but the defense being Wren Ventures. But Lucasfilm says no, we actually have had our own versions of this card game before, and we've announced that we're doing a movie focused on young Han Solo, and of course that is going to be part of this movie. So I think that Wren Ventures better take their lightsaber and go home, they're gonna lose their Millennium Falcon. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I mean, in addition to using the name, apparently it was either on the app itself, or maybe there was some advertising collateral with respect to the app itself that incorporated all sorts of copyrighted photographs and images from the various Star Wars franchise. So, yeah, I think this one might be problematic for Wren Ventures.
Yeah, it's pretty bold to call yourself Wren Ventures and then decide we're going to release a mobile app of Sabacc. Any thoughts, Margo?
None here, actually. Just seems really funny.
It does indeed. And then another just sort of quirky, wonderful trademark story is the story of the Italian brothers who noticed, and people do notice these things, that Apple had never bothered to trademark the name Steve Jobs. So the brothers have a clothing company, and they decided, hey, we want to call our clothing company Steve Jobs. And they developed a cute little logo that is a J with a leaf on top of it and a bite taken out of it. And they're selling jeans and other things. And apparently they won some sort of administrative decision in their favor in Italy. And for the time being, they're going to be able to continue calling themselves Steve Jobs, even though Apple does not want that to happen. Do you think that will continue indefinitely, Mike?
You know, it could be. I mean, the trademark laws vary by country. I can tell you that the result in the U.S. Would likely be quite different, because in the U.S., we have a system whereby it's not a race to the trademark office to see who can get the first registration. Mm-hmm. We have a use-based system, meaning that you acquire rights and trademarks by using them in commerce. And once you do that, you've acquired rights in whatever that particular mark is. And so if somebody races off to the trademark office and gets a registration before I do, if I've already been using it, I can get that trademark registration canceled. And in some European countries, as I understand it, it's not a priority-based system in terms of use. You actually, if you can get to the trademark office and get it registered before somebody else, you may have superior rights to the name. So it's quite different than what we typically think of here in the U.S. And it sounds like these guys were able to, you know, take advantage of the laws there in Italy and make a mad dash to their trademark office equivalent there and lock up the name.
Yeah. Do you think it makes a difference? There was some mention in this story that we have in our discussion points that there, you know, if I were them, I don't know if I'd be admitting this, but they think they may want to start a line of electronics at some point.
Yeah.
Seems like they might have a problem with that.
Yeah. I don't know. Cause I don't know the ins and outs of how it works in Italy there, but, mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess we'll see what happens in round two here if they decide to launch an electronics version of the clothing store.
Yeah, the story at The Verge speculates that if they do go down that road, you could see a Steve Jobs phone available on the market at some point that was not made by Apple, which would be weird, and I have a hard time seeing that would actually happen. Let's make our second MCLE passphrase of the show, Jobs Jeans. And if anybody owns a pair, please photograph yourself in them and send it our way. We will be happy to feature you on the show. In the meantime, though, we have a couple of fun terms of service stories for you. Just some things to mention here to keep an eye on, and one sort of trip down memory lane, courtesy of listener Danny Sims, who sent in a story that I remember we covered in 2010 when it happened, but I think Danny either just stumbled across it or wanted to bring it back, because after all, souls are immortal. And what happened in 2010 is, and this goes right to what you were saying earlier, Margot, about what people are willing to trade and what they read and what they don't read. There was a British firm called GameStation that wanted to make a point that it could put something just horrific in its terms of service and that people would not blink an eye and would totally agree to trade away their immortal souls, which they did. Something like 88% of their customers. I was actually surprised that it was not higher than that, but 88% of their customers agreed to trade away their immortal soul under the company's terms of service by placing an order via their website on a certain day. The first day of the fourth month, by the way, April Fools, of the year 2010 Anno Domini. Yes. So GameStation was careful to point out that this was a gag and that if they had any rights to anybody's immortal soul, that they were hereby surrendering said rights. And a good thing to remember. There was actually, they tried to even sweeten the deal. They provided an opt-out to the immortal soul clause. And if all you had to do was tick the box and opt out, and they even provided a £5 credit voucher should you decide to do that. Again, certain people actually caught that and did it. And that's what surprises me, not that 88% 90% of the people did not catch it. So thank you, Danny, for pointing out that terms of service are not something to be taken incredibly lightly, especially, too, if you're flying Delta or you're part of the Delta SkyMiles program, its loyalty program. This, I think, definitely bookmark this, because this won't be the first time, this won't be the last time that we see this. It may be the first time. I'm not sure it's even the first time that someone's done this. It certainly won't be the last time. And it has to do with hashtags. And what Delta has inserted into its SkyMiles terms and conditions is a license that if, and here's where it totally baffles me. It seized on the hashtags, hashtag SkyMilesLife and hashtag DeltaMedallionLife. Not just hashtag Delta. You know, if you're going to go for this, go for it in a big way. But no, they have these very sort of obscure hashtags that people agree in these terms of service that if they use that hashtag, they're granting rights to the photo that they've tagged to Delta. And they are also agreeing to indemnify Delta for any legal action that may befall Delta should it opt to use said tagged photo. So it's a pretty bold move in the terms of service, I gotta say here. If you're gonna be that bold, just, you know, hashtag Delta. Delta, I don't know why you have to make these obscure little hashtags, but maybe there was a reason for it, some sort of promotion they were doing or what have you. But just the fact that you're seeing a use of a hashtag made the pivot point for granting a license, I think is number one, outrageous. Number two, not going to be a unique scenario. So keep an eye on that and read your terms of service, because this is not quite the same as giving away your immortal soul, but it may be in this life more significant, because as the piece we have in our discussion points out, if you use one of these obscure hashtags and someone makes a claim against Delta because somehow, you know, you didn't actually have the rights to that image, you would be on the hook for Delta's attorney's fees. Or even if you did have the rights to that image, you would have to indemnify and defend Delta. And goodness knows you don't want to be doing that. So just thought that was a really fascinating thing that, again, came out over the holidays. Margo, any thoughts?
Yeah. That just seems like copywriting or, you know, liability-ing gone too far. It seems absurd to me. But I know there's a lot of absurd things, like if you don't put the hashtag ad in an ad. Well, that seems a little more reasonable. I don't have anything to say except that that's just beyond a normal human logic.
Yeah, I'm blaming the marketing department for this one. Marketing clearly got involved and decided to make a land grab or a sky grab, and somehow got the lawyers on board because they put it in the terms of service. just keep an eye. If anybody sees anything else like that, I'd certainly like to know about it. The other thing I'm keeping an eye on here, we've mentioned before, we mentioned when Mike Arrington took part in the first blockchain real estate transaction when he purchased a home, a condo, I believe, in the Ukraine, maybe an apartment, on the Ethereum blockchain, I want to say, using an Ethereum smart contract. I'm hesitant on that because Mike is involved in a different company called Propi, and I think they're using a different cryptocurrency and different smart contracts. So, there was that one transaction that was last, I want to say November, in the Ukraine. We are looking at one way or another soon the first U.S. smart contract for real property. And Propi may be involved in that. it thinks it's going to be the first real estate smart contract transaction. This involves a house near Lambeau Field that is listed for $1 million in cryptocurrency and would use a smart contract to culminate the transaction. So Propi is involved there, but then Emery noticed, Emery Roan, who couldn't join us here today, unfortunately, noticed that there's also someone on Reddit who has deeded their home into an Ethereum smart contract, a user called CryptoDude1, and I am unsure if that transaction has closed or not, but I am assuming it is a U.S. transaction. So I am just not certain which of these will be the first, but it looks to be one of them. Interestingly, the CryptoDude1 on Reddit is trying to make this not just his own or her own transaction, but has a site called smartlaw.io, which is looking to facilitate holding real estate in your Ethereum wallet, using smart contracts for not just house sales, but also loans. So that's something to watch as well. Looks to be something trying to either compete with Propi or just be in that same space. A bunch more information on smartlaw.io on GitHub as well, if you're interested in pursuing more about that. So, Mike, what do you think? Want to ballpark who does the first real estate transaction in the U.S. On a blockchain?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting, heady stuff. No predictions here.
No.
But I did see that Bitcoin went down, 20% just the other day? So instead of $1 million in Bitcoins, it's going to be 1.2 million or something that's going to be necessary? I don't know.
Yes. I guess that affects when you do your transaction is what Bitcoin or other currencies are trading at on that particular day. Really interesting. Definitely something to watch. Let's do our final, let's thank our final sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and then we will take it into outer space for our final story of the day. Our final sponsor of this episode of This Week in Law is Grasshopper, which is a virtual phone system designed for entrepreneurs. Grasshopper works just like a traditional phone system, but requires no hardware purchase. With their iOS and Android app, callers can reach you wherever you are on your mobile phone. Grasshopper allows you to keep your existing number so you can maintain your brand. When you make a call, your client will see your Grasshopper caller ID instead of your personal phone number. Simply select a toll-free or local number, record a custom greeting, and add multiple extensions for your business. Toll-free numbers are great for marketing and make your business sound more professional. Set up department and employee extensions with custom call forwarding to any phone in the world. You can also get voicemails emailed to you as audio attachments. You can also send and receive SMS text messages from your business number. Join the over 250,000 Grasshopper customers today. Plans start at just $12 a month, and you have a 30-day money-back guarantee. Turn your smartphone into a business line with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, go to trygrasshopper.com/twit. That's trygrasshopper.com/twit. Thank you so much, Grasshopper, for your support of This Week in Law. All right. We have our most spacey bumper to play as we round out the show today. I just love the other bumper. Over the holiday break, listener Ray Hill let me know, I was unaware of this until then, that there was rampant speculation about Elon Musk launching a Tesla, SpaceX and Elon Musk launching a Tesla Roadster into space on a Falcon Heavy rocket. And at first people were going, there's no way that's happening. It's just a rumor. And then Tesla came out with pictures and said, yeah, you know, we need to have various ballast and weight in the rocket. And why would you not want to make it the best kind of ballast and weight there is, a Tesla Roadster? And so they do appear to be going to do this. And when you read the coverage on it, it seems that they are going to launch it into some kind of Mars-related orbit. So you can read more about that and what SpaceX is up to there. And what Ray Hill was interested in, though, is what's the space law on whether or not someone else could launch a rocket to collect said Roadster from orbit as salvage. Obviously, lots of us would like to get our mitts on a Tesla Roadster. So they open up a can of worms about space law and salvage and what is junk or art in this context, or a practical component, I guess, of the Falcon Heavy rocket, since it's not going to be as heavy without its Tesla Roadster involved. So it's just sort of, I appreciated the question. I honestly don't know the answer. I do think that SpaceX would have something to say about it. It would either find a way to characterize the Tesla as far from being junk. And if there were concerns about the stability of the orbit, I think that affects how and when you can send something up to get it down for safety reasons. But it doesn't seem like that's going on here either, or would be going on for quite some time. Mike, any thoughts on this?
Boy, I'm not a space law expert by any means, but I would think Elon Musk would say, hey, look, I'm sending this up into space with the intent that it's ultimately going to come back. So I haven't given up dominion and control, and I still own my Roadster, even when it's, you know, thousands of miles away.
Yes, just love that SpaceX is doing this, and love that we're even asking these questions. Margo?
Yeah, this is just really fun for me to see. As a kid, I really wanted to go into space. I for real wanted to be an astronaut. But when I found out that we weren't going to go to the moon anymore, I got a little less into that. But this just sounds like fun. I'm
absolutely
excited that flights going into space are still going to happen. I don't know anything about the law here.
No, I'm not pretending that I know anything about the law here, but I did look up an article on space salvage, and it is in our discussion points, the law of space salvage, if you are interested in pursuing more about that. With that, we'll go ahead and get into our concluding material of the show here. We'll go ahead and lead off, as we often do, with our animal selfie of the week. Victor probably saw this one when it happened. It involved KTVU, which is that still Channel 2 in the Bay Area, Victor? Something like that.
Yeah, it's Channel 2.
Channel 2. And weather broadcaster there, and let's just play the video, and if you haven't already seen it, you'll enjoy.
But still some stubborn overcast here over the city. Look at this.
he totally checking out the camera, Mark.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
This is so cool.
Yeah. I might need a little more time for this weather segment, because we have a little visitor.
I was like, okay, I've seen it. I'm
perfect
done.
Perfect timing. That's out all. That was a little short-lived visit, but interesting there. So
this animal selfie of the week involved an animal who decided just to crash a weather forecast, and it wasn't even a trap cam. Would the animal have any argument to having a copyright in this footage? I'm guessing no. not even a little. Not having grabbed the camera and taken the photo itself. And plus the camera's just out there capturing whatever is out there. So lovely view of San Francisco and lovely view of said bird. I don't know if PETA would have a different take on that one, but I'm sure we'll hear from them. If so, let's see. Our resource of the week, of course, is Tech Law Tracker, Margo's show. Margo, we're, as we said at the top of the show, really, really glad that you've begun to do this. You're about six episodes in, am I right?
Yeah, I just released my fifth episode, so there will be plenty more to come. I plan on keeping this going through law school and maybe even after. I am excited to be a real podcaster because I've come a long way from listening to MuggleCast as a Harry Potter nerd. So, as a young child. So, yeah, I am really open to feedback. I love, you know, people to tell me what they think or errors that I make, because I'm sure I make plenty. I'm learning as I go along, and, you know, this has been really fun so far. So I'll keep it going. There's good. Lots more bills to read.
There are always a lot more bills to read, and it's not easy to digest them. So we're glad that you are
definitely
out there
not
doing that. And I think this is a great resource for people who are trying to get a handle on the differences in how tech policy develops across the various 50 states. So you can find that at techlawtracker.com. Our tip of the week has to do with whether everything has to be on a blockchain. Over at Motherboard, Samantha Cole and also Eva Galperin, who she reached out to from EFF for this piece, both conclude that your consent app doesn't need to be on the blockchain and probably shouldn't be. Now, we've had Michael Lissick on the show before, who is the founder and creator of WeConsent and the No app. So this is not the first time we have considered the existence of apps that try to grapple with the very, very difficult and complicated problem of granting consent to the things that consenting adults do with one another. when you involve the blockchain, Samantha and Eva Galperin are both concerned that you're adding a layer of permanency to consent that has absolutely no role in this particular context. So I guess our tip is, if you're going to build a consent app, go ahead and leave the blockchain out of it, because as Eva Galperin says in this piece, there is such a long list of things that don't belong on the blockchain, and this is high on the list. She also says it also reflects a profound lack of understanding of how the blockchain works. So whoever proposed this failed to understand the blockchain and consent and sex. So sorry about that. Legal things is the entity that came out with this particular blockchain associated consent app. Probably leave the blockchain out of it if you're pondering such a thing. And the point that they raise in this piece that applies, I guess, to any consent app, whether it's on the blockchain or not, is just that reducing that kind of consent to an enforceable contractual form is problematic. And on the one hand, it can be evidence. On the other hand, it can be evidence of something that you changed your mind about later on. So that's bad. And on the other hand, I have a hard time finding from a legal basis that any of this would be enforceable in a court of law. So it's a thorny issue. Mike, any thoughts?
Yeah, no, I agree with you.
Yeah.
Completely.
Yeah.
You know, the only thing I wanted to mention, it's not related to that. It's related to the selfie of the week that was in San Francisco. And of course, San Francisco is the federal courthouse or the federal court that decided the Naruto decision. So
that's true. Very true. Margo, any thoughts on consent apps?
That just sounds very funny. on a not unrelated topic, I remember a story a couple of years ago about, like, in Sweden, so many people are related that they needed an app to make sure that you're dating someone who's okay to date, that you're not their cousin. So they do all sorts of things with technology and dating and stuff like that. Yes. Fun clickbait for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. In her piece, Samantha Cole also writes, just sort of summing up, you know, how a consent app works. I enjoyed her description of this. She equates it to sending your would-be partner a request to agree to what boils down to a terms of service for the use of my body. I really like that. She's attempting to point out how ridiculous it is to try and boil that down to a terms of service. And I couldn't agree more. All right. With that, we'll go ahead and wrap up this episode of This Week in Law. It's been a great pleasure to get to know you, Margot. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been so great to be on This Week in Law. I've been a fan for a little while, so a little bit of a fangirl moment.
So nice glad. So glad you reached out, and great that you're doing your show and going to law school. Inspiring.
I look forward to many more Twill episodes while in law school. So.
Thank you. we hope to provide them.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, hopefully I get to stay, you know, abreast of the... Sometimes you do things like, oh, this would be a fun exam question. You know, maybe I'll get to suggest that to some professors and come out on top. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. And you could, you know, incorporate the permutations into your exam answers and hopefully sail through with flying colors. We aim to please. Mike, great to talk to you again.
Oh, this was a lot of fun. And Margot, thanks for being with us today, and best of luck to you in law school. I have one piece of advice for you before we go. It reminded me when we were covering the 7,500 immortal souls story. Mm. It reminded me, I was an adjunct for an internet in the law class a number of years ago, and we were always talking about terms of service. And so one of the things we put on our exam is a very long instruction sheet. And it said at the very top, you need to read through the instructions in their entirety before you take the exam. And what we buried in our little terms of service or our instruction sheet there was, you do not have to take this exam. You will get an A if you just come and bring it up and put it on our desk. You don't even need to take it. But so it was an interesting experiment. Not a single student took advantage of it. Everybody took the exam. So.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So read the instructions on any of your law school exams for any tricks like that.
That's hilarious.
That is very good advice. I'm going to keep that one in the noggin.
Okay, good luck.
One more thing I want to ask people to do before we get out of here today is our annual twit.tv survey is up and available for your completion pleasure. It's at twit.tv/survey, logically enough. And it really helps us out, helps us know what you're enjoying, what you're watching, feedback from you on all of the shows. So please, if you haven't done it already, go to twit.tv/survey and give us your thoughts. We only ask you to do this once a year, and now is that time. So jump on out there. And let us know what you think of This Week in Law and all the other shows on the Twit Network. Very helpful for us if you can do that. And while you're not doing that, if you're getting ready, if you're planning to tune in for your next episode of This Week in Law, you may have already figured out that we record the show on Fridays at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. That's when we're live. That's when you can join us for all the Skype drops and everything else that always happens during the show before any editing has gone into it whatsoever. We love having a live audience. So if you can do that, wonderful. If you can't, don't worry about it. You can get the actually reviewed and produced and released in their final form shows at twit.tv/twill. The whole archive of shows is there. So if you're interested in what we thought about the Grokster case when it was coming out, etc. Delve deep into those archives, and I'm sure that we will have much there for you to ponder and discuss and make fun of us if we got it all wrong, or call us oracles if we got it all right. So it's all all way back there in our deep, dim past. What else can you do? You can write to us. We really enjoy that. You can reach out to us on Twitter. That's a great way to let us know. Just spur of the moment, you see something that comes across your feed that you think we should know about. Just do it there in that moment and let us know that you saw it. We'd really, really appreciate it. If you have something longer to say, you can always email us. Mike is mike@twit.tv. I am denise@twit.tv. Reach out to us there or on Facebook as well. We have a page there where we are, you know, putting up things as we're considering putting them on the show. Love to hear from you there as well. We also have a Flipboard magazine. If you go to I Am D. Howell on Flipboard, and we have a This Week in Law magazine that you can actually contribute to if you'd like. If you'd like to help us sandbox things for the show, send me an email and I'll send you the link that makes you a Flipboard contributor to that magazine. And that way we can have all kinds of things to think about putting on the show the next time around. So all of those things are super helpful. We love your participation in the show. In fact, we could not do this show without all of your help and support. So thank you so much for that. Thank you for being with us this week, and we'll see you next time on This Week in Law. Take care.